Well, thank you very much indeed, Mr. King, for allowing me to come and talk to you. Could you just say for the tape, please, your full name and date of birth?
Arthur George King. I was born 27th of August, 1917.
And I believe you were involved in the guest house trade for part of your working life with your wife, or...?
I wasn't with my wife. I was with my wife, but, I mean, she ran the boarding house, as most did in those days, in the smaller houses. I carried on my normal occupation, and she ran the ran her own guest house. That was her total affair.
And can you tell me how you and how your family came to be involved in it? Was it an idea that she had or that you had?
No, her sister ran one in Brighton, and they came to the island, took a guest house in Peel Road, and persuaded her to take this house on, which was empty and was available, and a man would put hot and cold water in every bedroom if we would take it over. £120 a year. So she decided to have a go.
And had her family always been involved in hotels and guest houses?
No, not at all. No, only her sister had been in the trade in Brighton.
And what year was that you first started to look at that property?
Well, it was quick done. It was in around about 1960, I suppose, like somewhere around that figure. I couldn't quote a date.
I see. And I believe that the Isle of Man, you were telling me before, can you just tell me how your family came to move to the Isle of Man? It was the war, wasn't it, that sparked it off?
I was stationed here during the war. In the RAF. I was stationed at Craigneish with a radar unit. And hence I got to know Port St Mary and Port Tarin very, very well.
And did you then think that might be somewhere worth setting up a business when you heard, or more particularly when Mrs King heard?
Well, yes, I suppose so. Port Tarin was better than Port St Mary. You had a grand beach, a lovely beach there, and it was a very good family place. The only thing with the tourism then, you had to do full board. And it was a very, very labouring job to run them. Very demanding.
Can you just remind me the name and where your hotel was and what it was like?
Well, we took Belmont in Ballyfert Road, Port Erin.
And can you just see the building in your mind's eye? What would it be like when you took it on, in terms of how it looked and felt?
Well, it had everything going for it. There was only one bathroom, but we did manage to get a second one, which took a bedroom away.
And with yourself being in the building trade, was that an advantage for improvements and maintenance?
I didn't do any maintenance because it was rented property. No.
And did you ever toy with the idea of buying it, or were you quite glad to rent?
In those days, you couldn't think of buying. There wasn't that money about. It was hard times. You had to work very, very hard to get a living.
So, in terms of the family, sort of obviously you were working in the building line and Mrs. King was keeping the guest house. Did you find that you needed both jobs to bring in the money, if you don't mind me asking? Was that something that helped?
I think we had a bit better standard of living as a result. But at the end of the day, the labour wasn't paid for. We left the island and we managed to get a small, was it 5 or 6 bedroom guest house in Eastbourne. You only did half board at double the rate you could get on the island. Your season started at Easter with weekends, and then you gradually picked up at Whitsun, and from the beginning of June you were solid right through to the end of October.
So very different to the Isle of Man.
Yes, there was nothing. And at the same time we were being pressurised by the tourist board, the government, I should say, for fire regulations, and we had to do all fire conform with all fire regulations at that time. And the strange thing is that I've come back here since and find that in Douglas they still haven't done fire regulations. So why we were penalised out there so early and they were on the doorstep. Everything was pushed on to the outsiders, I think, and Douglas got away with it for so long.
Was the short season a real handicap of trying to make money in the island?
It was. Very, very hard. Very, very hard indeed.
So can you tell me what sort of season you'd experience and how it would go up and down in your guest house, your wife's guest house?
Well, you just started about the beginning of June, and then you filled up for the school holidays, and more or less after that, it was out, finished. They were families. True, you could pack them in, but you needed to. But you couldn't do it today. The demand today is, well, I would say that the old guest houses do not lend themselves for much for conversion into the modern day holiday accommodation demanded. Things have changed. And, I mean, the rooms were big. You could get two double beds in a bedroom and you put them in and you filled them in. But, I mean, today it's got to be... Plus, they want all en suite now. So, I don't think the old guest houses have a place today in the tourist trade.
And did you see the Manx trade changing over the years that you were involved?
Oh, yes. They were going down, it was going down. And I would think that possibly when the boys' brigades and those stopped coming, you see, the parents stopped coming. Then...
From England?
From England, oh yes, from Scotland. From Scotland, a large portion, and Liverpool. They came from all over the north of England. And then the trade in the cotton trade changed. Now, one would get a lot of people from the cotton industry. They had the firm would save the money for them. They'd pay so much in a week. And the Yorkshire people, and I suppose Lancashire maybe, I noticed it more with the Yorkshire people. They were very thrifty and bought shares in the cotton trade, in their own cotton trade. And they took that money for holidays. Sold the shares and had made their holidays that way, made money. We got some from the coal industry at that time, but since then, of course, all those industries have gone slumped. It's an unemployment area, so there's no holidays from them, nobody coming from there. And then, of course, the fairs. And we complain about the fares across with the steam packet, but, you know, the steam packet can only carry less than half the passengers on a ferry that they used to do, due to safety regulations. I think at times they put 3,000 people on some of those ships in the olden days, on each trip. So there's many factions, so that the steam packet have got to raise their fares to meet that.
I'm interested in other things, because I think you're the first person I've spoken to whose family has been involved in running a hotel in two different towns. And so what other differences were there between Port Erin and Eastbourne, or the Isle of Man generally, that you felt in the trade or the visitors, or maybe how things like the government and the tourist board helped or hindered you?
We weren't hindered at all by Eastbourne Corporation, or not by the Hotel Association either. Well, I wouldn't say we were hindered here, except fire regulations. You each advertised in the guides in the olden days the same, and you got what you know, but competition was so great you couldn't put your tariffs up because everyone was fighting to get customs at that time. The cream, I would say, went out of the tourist trade here middle of 50s when that went out of the island. Quite a few of the, there is this much about it, that a lot of the houses had been having the same clients come year after year, and of course they continue to come. But the new houses, the people who are just beginning, they didn't necessarily get many of them back again, only the parents of the boys' brigades or something like that. And because the boys are coming over, but they stopped coming. I don't know why, but they stopped coming. And we couldn't pull from any other source. You had the mills and the pits closing. So is that, I would say that that attributed to quite a bit of the drop in the tourist trade here. Now I don't think, you've got a tourist trade. You can say much now, only unless they start on sport. They've got to do more in sport, where they'll people who will travel.
Whereas in Eastbourne, were you having the same class of person coming, or was it a different type of, because you mentioned they would be workers in the cotton trade or the pits for the Isle of Man. Where were your visitors in Eastbourne working when they were back
home? All over England. Well, I would say not so much to the north, although you were getting, you would get some people travelling, but for air trade, no. We got they bet the Midlands and down, and they came year after year. Eastbourne was an old people's holiday resort. One man said that he could always tell when he got to Brighton Station where the which platform to go for Eastbourne, and that was to follow everybody with sticks. Brighton was for youth, and Eastbourne was for the elderly. And we had a band, we had a military band playing all through the summer on the promenade at the bandstand. And of course they would all go along to listen to that. It's a different band every fortnight.
But it seems that in Eastbourne, as you say, you were offering half board and you were able to charge more for it.
Double what you could hear. Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that was? Why the difference?
Demand. We took over an empty house. The health people had closed the other one down before us, and the people had only had the place 18 months and it was filthy. So we took it over empty, and we had to redecorate it. I gutted the kitchen, I did various, I modernised it everywhere, and we opened up. We had no customers whatsoever. We were too late to, I only got it in February, and I opened it the end of April, and I was filled up by the people up the street. And in October, they said, you've got to go for a holiday. Well, we'd had some good returns and we felt hard of spending the money. Anyway, so you've got to come, we filled you up. And we went to Mallorca with them for a fortnight. And when we came back, people were knocking on the doors. And we opened up again. And they begged us to open for Christmas. And I've still still in touch even now with people that stayed with us.
And how did that compare with Port Erin, that experience?
Well, we made great friends. Oh, you made a lot of friends. I'm still in contact with people that stayed with us in Port Erin. Oh, yes.
Opening for Christmas and having people knocking on the door.
Oh, no, not here. Nothing at all. Nothing at all. It's absolutely dead. It's absolutely dead for the rest of the year. Just that one short period. There was the Bell Queen, which had a very, very good name. And they had a very good connection. Very, very good connection. They came year after year, those people there. And also another house, the Belmore. Belmore, along on the promenade, another house on the promenade, two sisters ran it. That was another one that they came year after year after year. They had no worries, you see, but the others, more or less everybody else, more or less folded up. I can't quote in Port Erin so much. I think theirs dwindled the same. They were all fighting for.
How many houses of a similar size to yours were there in Port Erin when you were there in the 60s, do you think?
I don't really know. I couldn't say.
And you mentioned the Bal Queen. Now, you were saying about the swimming competitions and how
yes.
you managed to
Well, they took in 250 people.
So can you just tell me a bit about the swimming? I believe your children were very much into it.
Oh, yes. Very much so. My son was was in charge of it when he came home from college. He got his life-saving certificate, so he was competent to be in attendance. And he all the time he was home from college, he was in charge. And he ran all the regattas under the clerk of the commissioners. And it was very successful. Very successful during those days.
And was there a trophy?
Trophies. There were trophies every week being awarded. And prizes, of course.
And how did your hotel manage to... You said the Bal Queen used to win a lot of them, but then you managed to...
Well, we cheated a bit, I think, because ours weren't guests, all guests that we... But we... I had three children who were excellent swimmers, and... often enough, we had people who stayed with us. Their sons were in the boys' brigade. And we could pick four good ones out each week. And we held the trophy right through the season. So, much to the annoyance of Bal Queen. They always held it, really. But until we came on the scene. I suppose you could say we were cheating.
It must have been good publicity, though.
It was good publicity, yes. But it was. But then, you see, you weren't... Yes, it was good publicity for anybody who was over here, but it didn't do you any good away, not for recruiting more visitors, really.
And did you ever place adverts and something, things like that in the papers, of course?
In the tourist guide, only. Only in tourist guide. We tried... I can't remember the name of the paper. We did try one or two papers, but they didn't bring anything at all, no. And you felt very hard of paying money out when you weren't getting anything back, any return.
What about when you were in Eastbourne? Did you advertise there?
In the tourist guide, that's all. Yes, that did bring. That was good for us. That was good for us. But for the most part, I would say that we were filled up by the street. We didn't need to advertise the latterly when we had it. We didn't need to advertise because they all came back again the following year.
Can you just remind me of the name of your hotel again in Port Erin?
Belmont.
The Belmont, that's right. So can you just tell me, what was it like when you first moved in? Was it old-fashioned or was it in good condition? What if you were to see it in your mind's eye as you went in, what was it like?
Well, it was ordinary. We had to decorate it right out when we got it. It hadn't been decorated for a long time, and we had to start from top to bottom, redecorate it right through. There were the big two big bedrooms. Well, there were two big bedrooms on the first floor, and I can't remember what they were up above. Then we had an attic, and we put the lounge up on the first floor, and we converted the two rooms downstairs for the a dining room, two reception rooms, into a dining room to seat them.
So you did quite a lot of work, really, even though it was rented, you were putting something
yes, into it. Yes, oh yes, yes.
And
that they were all guest houses up there, up the road, not as big as ours. Ours was the bigger one, was the biggest in that road. I don't know why this one was bigger than the others. I think there's about five up that road.
And how many bedrooms would you have again?
I think we had 11, but we took one for another bathroom.
Were the guests asking for that, or did you feel it?
No, we felt it necessary. Felt it very necessary. I mean, you wouldn't get away with that now. But, of course, in those days, people would what they'd never had, they'd never missed, I suppose, when they'd been away on holiday. And of course, things have changed.
Were there a lot of people running the same system as Mrs. King and yourself, of the wife running the boarding house?
Oh, they were all doing it. Oh, well, most of them. And the smaller ones were all doing the same. Church Road was the same. They were working. There were one or two in Church Road, Port Erin. I know they were, the husbands were working. And next door to me was working one side. There were two ladies on the other side of me, of us. And then the man was working in the next one. Then the next road up again, there were husband and wife. They were, they ran it between them. And farther up, I can't remember just how, but most, for the most part, in those houses, the husbands were leading their own lives and the wives were getting pin money, as they used to call it.
Did Mrs. King enjoy the business? Did she find it a sort of something she liked?
She liked the job. Sure, she liked it. Oh, yes, yes, yes. We only ran it at in Eastbourne for 5 years because my wife went blind with cataracts. We had to get out quick. They came on quick and she had to get out. That's why we finished, packed it in. We had to close it then. Only through health.
Just thinking, it might be very interesting if you could tell me a little bit. You said you worked in the radar during the war.
I was with the radar unit. I wasn't in it. Right. I was a part of the crew, part of the station.
So
headquarters.
That was when you first experienced the Isle of Man as well.
Yes.
Can you remember coming here for the first time?
I do. What it was like? I do. I came. I was. We had to rush up a radar station on the extreme end of. Carnarvonshire, at a place called Aberdaron. The aircraft were, German aircraft were bombing the convoys going past there. We saw them of a night. And we had to rush this station up quick. All the pieces, everything was lying round in the gorse. And we rushed it up, and as soon as it was up, I was posted over here. So I said to the, I was posted to the Isle of Man, so I said, I'd heard of the Isle of Man, but didn't know where it was. So I said to the orderly room corporal, well, we call him orderly room corporal because we hadn't got an orderly room corporal, we only had an old aircraft crate for an office. I asked him, how did I get there? So he said, I don't know. He said, I have to ring up headquarters to find out, to route you. So anyway, he said, you've got to go via Liverpool. To Liverpool. And then to Fleetwood. And you cross, you got on a boat at Fleetwood. So I said, where is Fleetwood? And he said, I don't know. So anyway, I went, I got to Fleetwood, and the boat hadn't sailed that the day before when we turned up for the boat. I was on my own from this station, but I met another fellow who was going to Port St Mary. So we kept together, of course. Well, that we were couldn't come on the boat, there wasn't room. So we were put in a guest house in Blackpool for the night. And they told us that if we that to go down to the to Squire's Gate and get subsistence. So we walked down to Squire's Gate, a gang of us. There were other airmen coming over to the island, and we got a shilling. So then we came back up and we came across on the boat, and we came ashore, and then we got you got your full kit and your kit bag. And we struggled up with their kit bag onto to get on the bus, and the conductor came for the fare, and a gentleman said, "Oh, don't worry, lads, I'll pay your fare up to the station." So he paid our fare up to the station, and then we saw the train, and we couldn't believe our eyes. It amused us. We said, "Does it go?" And of course, we found it had got square wheels. And then we got to Port St Mary, and the truck was there waiting for us. And of course, we were taken and up to the Carrick Hotel, which was their rendezvous. And at that time, it was ran by a man and his two nieces. And we were full board in there.
So it was all requisitioned by the RAF?
Yeah, it was. Well, they were requisitioned in that way, but they eventually took over the hotel completely and ran it themselves. Everything was RAF then. There's nobody else in there then. And that was the headquarters, should we say, where we got. And then the vans, the trucks used to go up daily, two or three times a day, with changing the watches up at the Craignish. I don't know how long that station had been up at Craignish. I didn't know.
So what was your particular job?
I was medical. Mm. I was a British in a Class E reservist in the British Red Cross before the war. And I'd signed on the dotted line. I was willing to serve. And my papers came the morning after war was declared at 9 o'clock in the post. And I got to be at West Drayton by 6 o'clock that night. And that was the story. Now, first off, I was with Coastal Command, Sunderland Squadron at Plymouth, till we were bombed out. And when we were bombed out, we were dispersed. The squadron, the aircraft and the fitters, they all went to Poole in Dorset, where it was safer for them, because we lost too many aircraft there. And we were dispersed. The headquarters staff were dispersed. I was sent to the Air Ministry, Whitehall, until I was made up to a corporal and posted out to Aberdaron.
And when you were staying in the Carrick Bay, did you ever see any of the internees?
You saw them every day. Oh, well, I say saw them every day. They were on the promenade only. They were locked in the promenade. They had Chapel Beach. The general public in Port St Mary had no access at all to Chapel Beach, not at all. And they had Chapel Beach, and every Tuesday and Friday, I think, they were released to go shopping, and they ran down the shops. I think that's when the shopkeepers made their fortune, because they had plenty of money. Well, then it was my duty. I had to see to the welfare of all the men. And dentist.
The men in your unit.
Yes. I would have to get a permit out, apply for a permit to the police every week to take an escort of men to the dentist. McCard's a dentist in Port Erin. And we could go to the cinema with a permit. That camp was all interned, but we didn't see when we went to the dentist. We never saw many of the women. They were single women too, We didn't see many of those, although the place was full of them, I believe.
And your unit, I mean, radar must have been something quite hush-hush at the time.
Oh, it was.
Were you forbidden to speak of
it? Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah.
And what was the actual layout of the Craigneish station like? I mean, what sort of buildings and who would be doing what in that place?
Well, it was all there was up there, really, up on the top there, was a shed for the generators. And then you had a gantry with a big mesh aerial turning all the time. And operations room in there where they were scanning. And stores up there. That's all there was up there.
And what particularly were you looking at for aeroplanes coming up the Irish Sea?
Well, that was their job, not mine. Yeah. And then we had the army were at the defence for the island, and they were at Perwick. I think it was the Cheshire Regiment there.
It must have been strange in Port Erin and Port St Mary with most of the, you know, internees and then the military establishment. Did the locals ever grumble at you all?
No. We were, you see, we're only a small number. And the Manx people in the locality, they treated us very, we were treated very, very well by the Manx people. And it was rather amusing because in the Bay Hotel, women weren't allowed in it. There was a spinster, Miss Clulo, and she wouldn't allow any woman come in the pub. Oh no, it was unusual, very unusual that. And
so even though the war was on, she kept it respectable?
Oh yes, yeah, oh yes, it was very respectable, yes, yes.
And did you ever dream that you'd end up coming back to...
No, not at all. I didn't want to, particularly want to. I'd got a good job. For those days, I was with a good... And we had, as a matter of fact, the day after war was declared, I was working at the house of Sir Edward Molfe, the architect who designed and built Guildford Cathedral. And that was the type of work we had, all the big, best houses all round. I mean, they were big houses. And the people all wanted the same men back every time there was any work to be done. You each had, this firm, you each had your own houses to go to work. If there's a job to be done, that was yours. That's how the wealthy people liked it best, that they knew who was there. They knew you well by your name, and by a Christian name. And I can well remember one lady threw her arms around me, pleased to see me back. And her son was a squadron leader pathfinder, and he changed hands 5 times from the time he crashed. He changed hands by the people, you know, I can't think of the name, what they called them. Anyway, resistance and the Germans. 5 times he changed hands, and in the meantime, his arm was damaged, and his arm had the resistance left him to the Germans, probably they would have repaired his hand quite good. But the president, when I last heard, he couldn't use that hand, one hand. It was still there, but dead.
You've certainly seen an interesting cross-section of life, Mr. King, from the boarding house trade, the RAF, the building trade.
Yes, yes.
A lot of interesting stories to tell.
Oh, yes.
Thank you very much indeed for sparing me some time. It's much appreciated.